Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. With climate change, contamination, and a host of stressors on the planet, how will we feed a growing population? What are the politics of food?
In this symposium about the future of food, recorded before a live audience, we'll turn to solutions. How can we protect long-term sustainability of healthy food? And what changes do we need to be sure our system is just, sustainable, and resilient?
My name is Manuel Vallée. I'm a senior lecturer here in the sociology department at the University of Auckland, and I'm a co-organizer for this symposium along with Maria Armudian. We have an excellent panel to discuss food-related issues. On the panel, we have Anastasia Telesetsky, who's a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief, Ecological Restoration and International Environmental Law, and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia-Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers, and he's authored book chapters including Constructing Economic Objects of Governance, the New Zealand Wine Industry. Richard Lehrheran is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, Economic Spaces of Pastoral Production and Commodity Systems, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Sociology of Food and Agriculture, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, Food Utopias, Reimagining Citizenship, Ethics and Community, as well as Biological Economies, Experimentation, and Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. So with no further ado, I hand it off to Maria.
Thank you, Manuel Vallée. So what I thought we should do is first go and do a kind of a recap, but expansion. I'm going to have Michael Carolyn do this piece because it's sort of encapsulated in one of his books about cheap food. The idea is that it's really expensive. So Michael Carolyn, perhaps you can give us in a nutshell, what are these costs that we're missing when it comes to cheap food?
Thanks for inviting me and thanks for having me here. And I'll just make 2 points on that. So I did write the book, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, and the second edition just came out this year. And I do believe it's important that we think about the costs that are externalized in our food system, because as was documented extremely well with the previous panel, we lack a total cost accounting when it comes to our food system. Cheap food is a euphemism for fossil fuel dependent exploitive food. You can go on and on about what cheap food really means. But I think there's an element to that. Now, the 2 points I want to make, I think, build upon things that were just kind of subtly touched upon in the first panel. The first is we have to ask the question, why do we have cheap food to begin with? And of course, there's lots of reasons, and we can drill it all the way down to capitalism and neoliberalism. But I want to take us back to our very first cheap food, which was arguably sugar. There was a wonderful book written on the history of sugar by Sidney Mintz, the late famous food anthropologist. And he links sugar to being one of the first, if not the first, cheap foods. And he asked the question, essentially the book asked the question, why sugar and why did it emerge when it did? And part of the reason why sugar emerged as a cheap food when it did was a way of justifying low wages, right? If you are able to provide cheap calories to a workforce, then that workforce doesn't have as much authority or legitimacy to argue for a better cost of living if their cost of living is depressed in other ways, such as a slum living and feeding them sugar and things like that. And so one of the things that we have to also have a conversation about when we talk about internalizing those costs is we have to make sure that people then can afford what is inevitably going to be more expensive food, right? It's hard to say that if you internalize all the costs, even with permaculture, other things like that, that you can still have a dollar hamburger or 99-cent dozen eggs. And so one thing about food policy that I think we miss is some of these broader conversations, at least we get caught up with this in the United States, is food and farm policy is reduced to production agriculture, and it misses all these other elements. One of the biggest risk factors for hunger, for food insecurity, is poverty. So if you really want to address food security and hunger, you would address things like income, have conversations about a livable wage, have conversations about universal health care or affordable health care, have conversations about land tenure, have conversations about education. And these are conversations that I think that we sometimes miss. And it's hard. We as a society, when I talk about cheap food and a need to internalize cheap food, I'll immediately get someone raising their hand saying, what do you have against having someone afford to be able to feed themselves and their family? And they're right. Unless you have that other conversation about income or inequality, things that Annie talked about, you're missing a huge piece of this broader conversation about who has access to food and who doesn't, and who has access to a higher quality of life and who doesn't too. So the other point I'll just very briefly make too, and I think we'll talk more about this to pivot it more toward a solution piece, and it's something that I'm personally really interested in with my own research, is this question of how do we make people want to change their food system, right? I feel this viscerally as an educator too. Again, I spend entire semesters telling students how what we're currently doing is destroying our planet. And yet, I don't know if I've honestly ever changed anybody's behaviors. So I have a question about how we currently engage in politics. Now, our understanding of politics in the West is really centered upon this idea of just communication, of dialogue. It's a very, to refer to something that Annie talked about, very an unembodied understanding of politics. And I engage in that type of politics in every one of my classes where I have debates and conversations, present students with facts about why they ought to change their behavior. And I don't know if any of them actually do. And so I'm really interested as a scholar in what makes us think we ought to do something different. And I think there's a real important embodied practice material piece. And I know this sounds very abstract right now, but I think we'll have an opportunity in this panel to drill down more about what I mean by that. I think we're missing an element of our politics, a politics of care, a politics of recognition, politics of how we can empathize with people that are different and distant socially from ourselves. And until we also have a conversation about what that looks like, what that means, what does it mean to make people change their views in the world that will ultimately result in behavioral changes, I think we're missing a big piece of this conversation. How do we get people to want social change? And I think we'll maybe get to some of that later today.
And before we completely move off of that, Michael Carolyn, the cost of cheap food, there were some things in that book that you have not said and that I just wanted you to connect the dots to. One was about conflict and one was about creating more refugees. And those are two big conversations that are happening now, but they're not happening around food. How is it connected to food?
So I guess this does, a little quicker than I thought, bring us to some of the things that I've been studying about how do we make people empathize with one another, empathize with people that are different than themselves and who may live on the other side of the globe. And so let me just give really quickly two empirical examples of some things that I've found that make me hopeful in terms of some of these alternative food networks. Now, I know when we talk about alternative food networks, we talk about them often in the context of nutrition or food that's tastier or food that's been raised sustainably, but I've seen and been able to document some other elements to how some of these interactions that are based around alternative food networks might actually have some regenerative value as well. And that's around how it can make us, in some instances at least, what I like to refer to as citizen eaters as opposed to just food consumers. And so in one example, one case study, I did a longitudinal study where I interviewed roughly 110 people before they entered into an alternative food space for the first time, a cooperative, farmers markets, community support agriculture, things like that. And then I interviewed them again 2 years later, and I tried to trace their attitudinal and behavioral changes as a result of these encounters, these physical encounters that go beyond just who they talk to. And what I found interesting is I actually was able to link to these spaces, these practices, attitudinal and behavioral changes. Now, of course, the people that go into these spaces tend to be different than your regular conventional consumer. But I also discovered that their behavioral and their attitudes change as a result of these practices themselves. Now, one just quick example. When people were asked why did they enter these spaces for the first time, they overwhelmingly said they did so because they thought the food was healthier and then because they thought the food tastes better. When they were interviewed again 2 years later, they still thought those things, but they prioritized something different. They remained in those spaces because of the social connections they had with others, what it taught them about the environmental sustainability issues. And in one case, one subgroup, I interviewed people that were attached to community-supported agriculture where they had the opportunity to volunteer for their subscription. And so, in a sense, you work off some of what you owe. And what's interesting about this space is it brought affluent retirees together with immigrants from impoverished households that are very different politically and socioeconomically speaking together. And what I found is that these interactions with people that were different from themselves, even though those white, affluent, rich, in some cases conservative voters might have been into those, went to those spaces in order to get cheap, affordable, healthy, good-tasting food, they remained and stayed in those spaces because they really started to value these interactions with people different from themselves. And they began to express feelings of empathy with people who they might have 2 years prior demonized. And so I've got other cases, too, and examples like that that I might have a chance to talk about today. But I think there's some really important things that we can learn from our interactions that result from these spaces that can lead us to start to sympathize and empathize with refugees or people that are different, who pray to a different God, who have a different colored skin, who speak a different language, who may not even be within our own community, but might be living in a country thousands, tens of thousands of kilometers away. And so those are the questions that I'm really interested in, too, is, you know, how do we make people feel like they have an ethical obligation for people that they'll never meet, who may live in an entirely different country, too? And there may be some evidence that these spaces actually generate what scholars of justice refer to as a politics of recognition.
Perfect. Thank you. So now what I'd like to do, because I want to get into this idea of, can we create these new systems? And part of that may be connected to the legal issues. Anastasia Telesetsky teaches in the law school here, and she looks at these rights, like the right to food, but also a right to an environment. And where does the law come in? Where does the policy come in? Can you lay this out first, Anastasia?
Yeah, thank you very much, Maria. One of the pleasures I have this year is I'm teaching one of the first food law classes to be offered here at a New Zealand law school. And one of the subjects we're looking at is indeed the right to adequate food. And this is a right that's recognized in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and has been expanded upon in the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and is also present in some of the other international conventions to which New Zealand is a party, including the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So it is well established as a New Zealand obligation. Now, having said that, it is not part of the New Zealand Bill of Rights. It is not a component of that, and nor is it specifically, explicitly implemented through parliamentary legislation. And that has been an issue that has been raised by scholars and communities here in New Zealand. What I want to sort of share with you, because I know this is the question of what is the future of food? Well, the future of food is having a right, a human right, that is actionable. And so part of this is asking the question, with what the right to adequate food is not a calorie count. It's not whether you have 2,000 calories per day. It is a question of whether you have accessibility to food, whether you have availability of food, and that is a question of whether it is also appropriate food, culturally appropriate food, as well as food that is free from adverse substances. That is the sort of internationally agreed definition of what the right to food entails. So one of the sort of, I'm going to wind up here because I want to ensure that we have a conversation up here, but I want to emphasize that one of the things that New Zealand needs to be focusing on is having a food security plan. New Zealand does not have an explicit right to adequate food plan. And what that entails is going on the ground and looking at the sort of sources of food, trying to understand a lot of work I do in disaster law, whether New Zealand would be able to sustain the ability to keep its food supply systems open. You know, there is a lot of dependence on other nations for some of the food that is currently being supplied here in New Zealand, and raising questions about thinking about how is food more than simply an industry here, and really something that is a right. And so I'll wind up with that.
Before I let you off the hook, sure. Anastasia Telesetsky, how do we reconcile, this is both in your scholarship as well as on the previous panel, how do we reconcile that right to food with the right to a clean environment?
They're intrinsically linked. A right to food requires that the food is being raised in a sustainable fashion. And there are many ways to define sustainable, of course. But one of the movements underway is to really be thinking a lot more about, for example, agroecology, understanding what is the environmental cost of our food. some of this requires, frankly, putting a lot more investment in. And then this would be government-oriented investment to understand how you can do food production. We know that here in New Zealand, we have a unique situation with the Maori having a lot of powerful practices and how to recover some of these practices. Some of these will be community-based, and some of these might, frankly, require some additional financing in order to scale them up.
Richard LeHaren, let's bring you in. You and Nick Lewis here to my left have both been talking about how we've bifurcated the economy from the environment and social systems and how these are actually really linked, but we don't see it that way. How do you see this as a problem that can be resolved?
Well, it's the curly tail that's a really difficult bit. We can have a discussion on the first part fairly easily. I mean, thinking about that, I'm very conscious of the fact that we could pose for the experience of the dairy industry in New Zealand, could it have been done differently? And I think the answer is that there have been other possibilities, and certainly Mike Joy, with his scholarship, has been delving into that over many years. But a couple of key points that will help get across the idea of doing dairying differently is that there has been a strong organic movement in New Zealand that came from other parts of the world that's had its ups and downs. And in the case of dairying, did have a bit of an up, and then Fonterra decided that it wouldn't purchase organic milk anymore because something had happened in the US cheese market and so on. But that stands as an alternative, and the alternative in that case centres very much on let's keep many of the industrial chemicals out of the soil. And the second example would be biological agriculture dairying. And that's an example, largely invisible in fact, where the emphasis is on cultivating the soil and soil biota rather than necessarily the obvious products of the cows that will produce milk and such like. And that's had an interesting history. It continues to exist. Evidence seems to be accumulating that you can make a useful living from it. But you're left with, why is it so invisible? And so what we have in those two examples, which touch on, but by no means represent the kind of overwhelming revolution that some of the speakers in the first panel were sort of edging us towards, that things can actually be done differently.
Mm. Yeah. Well, Nicholas Lewis, this brings us to you, and you, some of the things you've talked about is, well, how do we bridge the environment with the economy in such a way that's ethical or that's moral and have an economy that is a moral economy? How do you see it?
I get the toughest one. Maybe I'll edge my way into answering that question in two ways. And what Richard laid in front of you is a proposition that we need to do economy differently if we're going to address this question. We have to do food economy differently. Otherwise, we're left in a space where we have people arguing for making money out of food and being pushed into the corner of effectively arguing for the agri-science industrial complex that we've heard so much about. Or alternatively, we have people arguing for the environment and leaving the question of the economy aside and how it is that we produce, distribute food that we all rely upon. But food economy is necessary. So the question becomes, how do you do that economy? And I think by the same token, food politics is necessary. And so you have the age-old turn in good critical social science to political economy. There's no economy without politics, and there's no politics without economy. So I just want to add something to what Anastasia said and then get back to this question of moral economy. That point is that we can do this, we can hold people to account through policy and law, but we can also hold them to account in different kinds of ways. And we've been doing some work as part of the Sustainable Seas National Science Challenge with seafood and with an industry that is often held up to be one of the great devils of contemporary 21st century food, and that's the fishing industry. And through a load of pressure coming from multiple different directions, go see Seafood New Zealand's website and a set of promises about sustainable futures, about doing things differently, and in fact, promise number six, about being transparent. And say, okay, we take you at your word. Now let's hold you to account for that word. And I think there are multiple ways of doing that, and that's a different way of thinking about consumer choice to the way we were thinking about it slightly earlier. So the return there to questions of moral economy and ethical economy is that if we do commit to doing economy differently, we have to think about economy for whom and where, or production, farming, production of food for who and where, how we do that kind of farming. And I'll just refer you to a wonderful little article written by a geographer, Peter Jackson, and some of his colleagues, who talk fundamentally about moral economy. And they raise the question of the chicken and sugar and questions like that. The more you get distanced from the social relations of production, the eater is distanced from the maker of that food, the more it is possible to ignore moral questions and ethical questions. So there is something about the way in which not just the industrial agriculture, but the globalizing of industrial agriculture has added to these particular questions. And I will leave you with one point, if that's all right.
Yeah, go ahead. One point, because you just made me want to ask another question.
But one point is, I think the way forward on this, if I were to use one word, is experimentation. We should be encouraging and committed to experimenting in lots of different ways, in lots of different places, with making food, with distributing food, with the values, the cultural values we attach to food, the things we get out of eating, and the way we eat food. And I think that level of experimentation brings back precisely what Annie said earlier about these kinds of embodied performances of food, not just in eating it, but in making food.
Nicholas Lewis, you've said two things that prompt questions for two of the other panelists. One of them is about the globalization of food and what that has done. The other is about how really, even when we think we're eating alone, we're not eating alone, because there are all of those people that were involved in the production and the delivering and et cetera, of the food. So I think I'm going to throw the first one over to Richard LeHaron about globalization, interacting with the individual and with the community, and what that interaction is and does to our choices and what we ultimately see.
Yes, when we speak of globalization, we should also think about localization, because things are very genuinely connected. The first observation I'd make is that New Zealand almost is running at a disadvantage with respect to selling abroad. And so the connections by way of ecological scrutiny and feedback in that sense from market trends, which might be influenced by diet and such like, take a little longer to filter this way and such like. The second thing I think that is really important is that, in a sense, returning to the dairy example is probably helpful, is that what we're actually talking about is different values and expressions of those values through different means or practices or procedures of doing things. And then that, in the end, does sum up to there may be some different sorts of wider outcomes.
Can you give us some examples to make it more concrete?
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, I mean, in the case of biological agriculture, dairying, those who are committed to that will have a modest application of different fertilisers. They do an enormous amount of testing on a daily basis. And, you know, dairy farmers in New Zealand do a lot of testing, but these guys are just besotted by it. And so they really understand what's happening in the soil, because the soil translates into plant nutrition qualities, and that translates into what happens to the herd and what happens to milk quality. So ultimately, to pick up on a word that I don't think was... No, it was mentioned once in the first session, the word practices is really, really critical. And, of course, Nick's example of the seafood industry gets us right to that. We are committed to transparency. Now, transparency is a practice, a political practice, that allows others to engage in the conversation, to actually perhaps engage in some co-learning over the matter, and perhaps define different sorts of commitments and so on, to take Mike's point through in terms of not quite making people do things, but at least opening pathways that allow people to arrive at more informed decisions and choices about what they might do.
Well, Michael, Carolyn, that brings you in twice. One is, first of all, that idea that you expressed in your book about eating alone, which is that we're not really eating alone. There are a lot of people involved in that. But it sounds like what you're arguing is, since there are so many people involved in that, maybe we need to connect the dots. Walk us through first what you mean by we're never eating alone, and then connect that to how do we get from point A to point B?
How we're not eating alone, where to even begin? I'll just give a couple examples. So she's referencing a book that had come out a few months ago called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And part of the book involves interviewing a whole host of CEOs and executives from various Fortune 500 firms, as well as interviewing food activists to try to kind of get both sides and try to tell a story about what it all means. And what was so interesting is there were even elements of our food system that I didn't even realize existed. And I've been studying it for close to 20 years now. I mean, I talked to a manager of an industrial vitamin plant in China, which was fascinating because, you know, all of our food is fortified with industrial vitamins. And we never think about where those industrial vitamins come in. We're so busy kind of tracing our food from fork to source, never even asking or even thinking to ask, where do the vitamins come from that produce that food? And he was telling me how most of their vitamin D comes from the lanolin of sheep from Australia. And so there's this crazy link from sheep and lanolin going from Australia, going to China, turned into vitamin D and going into all of our food. And I never got an answer, but if I think organic milk, at least in the States, it's fortified with vitamin D that comes from lanolin from sheep, it's still considered organic, even though the vitamin D is not. But there's just these really fascinating connections. There's all these people involved in our food system. So then it gets to the question, how do we get people to have a politics that they begin to realize that we are indeed eating alone? And we need a politics that kind of draws us outward, as opposed to what I see, we currently have a politics that more drives us inward.
Nicholas Lewis, you've said two things. One of them is about the globalization of food and what that has done. The other is about how really, even when we think we're eating alone, we're not eating alone, because there are all of those people that were involved in the production and the delivering and et cetera, of the food. So I think I'm going to throw the first one over to Richard Leheron about globalization, interacting with the individual and with the community, and what that interaction is and does to our choices and what we ultimately see.
When we speak of globalization, we should also think about localization, because things are very genuinely connected. The first observation I'd make is that New Zealand almost is running at a disadvantage with respect to selling abroad. And so the connections by way of ecological scrutiny and feedback in that sense from market trends, which might be influenced by diet and such like, take a little longer to filter this way and such like. The second thing I think that is really important is that, in a sense, returning to the dairy example is probably helpful, is that what we're actually talking about is different values and expressions of those values through different means or practices or procedures of doing things. And then that in the end does sum up to there may be some different sorts of wider outcomes.
Can you give us some examples to make it more concrete?
Yeah, sure, sure. Well, I mean, in the case of biological agriculture, dairying, those who are committed to that will have a modest application of different fertilisers. They do an enormous amount of testing on a daily basis. And, you know, dairy farmers in New Zealand do a lot of testing, but these guys are just besotted by it. And so they really understand what's happening in the soil, because the soil translates into plant nutrition qualities, and that translates into what happens to the herd and what happens to milk quality. So ultimately, to pick up on a word that I don't think was... No, it was mentioned once in the first session, the word practices is really, really critical. And of course, Nick's example of the seafood industry gets us right to that. We are committed to transparency. Now, transparency is a practice, a political practice, that allows others to engage in the conversation, to actually perhaps engage in some co-learning over the matter, and perhaps define different sorts of commitments and so on, to take Mike's point through in terms of not quite making people do things, but at least opening pathways that allow people to arrive at more informed decisions and choices about what they might do.
Well, Michael, Carolyn, that brings you in twice. One is, first of all, that idea that you expressed in your book about eating alone, which is that we're not really eating alone. Nobody's really eating alone. Even if you're sitting in your office with your lunch on your desk, there are a lot of people involved in that. But it sounds like what you're arguing is, you know, since there are so many people involved in that, maybe we need to connect the dots. So maybe walk us through first what you mean by we're never eating alone, and then connect that to the second point that you've been trying to make, which is how do we get from point A to point B?
How we're not eating alone, where to even begin? I'll just give a couple examples. So she's referencing a book that had come out a few months ago called No One Eats Alone, Food as a Social Enterprise. And part of the book involves interviewing a whole host of CEOs and executives from various Fortune 500 firms, as well as interviewing food activists to try to kind of get both sides and try to tell a story about what it all means. And what was so interesting is there were even elements of our food system that I didn't even realize existed. And I've been studying it for close to 20 years now. I mean, I talked to a manager of an industrial vitamin plant in China, which was fascinating because, you know, all of our food is fortified with industrial vitamins. And we never think about where those industrial vitamins come in. We're so busy kind of tracing our food from fork to source, never even asking or even thinking to ask, where do the vitamins come from that produce that food? And he was telling me how most of their vitamin D comes from the lanolin of sheep from Australia. And so there's this crazy link from sheep and lanolin going from Australia, going to China, and being turned into vitamin D and going in all of our food that's being, and I never got an answer, but if I think organic milk, at least in the States, it's fortified with vitamin D that comes from lanolin from sheep, it's still considered organic, even though the vitamin D is not. But there's just these really fascinating connections. The other one, I talked to someone who's in the industrialized salmon business, and he showed me a paint deck. If anyone's seen those, it's one of those things that fans out and gives you all the colors of the rainbow when you're painting your house. And he showed me literally one of those and told me that you can pick the flesh of your salmon to any one of these colors, and then that determines the feed and the feed ratio. So you can select your flesh colors as well. And so there's all these kooky, fascinating stories about our food system that you just never even think about. I mean, that was my point about there's all these people involved in our food system. Yes, there's the farmers and there's the workers, but then the managers of vitamin D plants in China and people that you go to pick the flesh color of your salmon. So then it gets to the question, how do we get people to have a politics, you know, that they begin to realize that we are indeed eating alone? And we need a politics that kind of draws us outward, as opposed to what I see, we currently have a politics that more drives us inward. And I make this argument in part based upon my interviews with these individuals from big food firms too, in that how they were readily admitting that they're co-opting some of these narratives about the importance of feeding your family healthy food. You know, these are things that corporations can co-opt and profit from, and they are. I mean, look at the branding of health claims that surround all of our packaging, so they can get behind a lot of those things. And they talk about that. I mean, look at their branding. You deserve a break today, right? McDonald's famous one. I have people talking about how they're trying to co-opt slow food. Not that McDonald's has anything to do with slow food, but this notion that your life is too fast, as Annie talked about, you need to slow down, come to McDonald's, and we can do that for you. And so they're very much focused on these politics that bring you inward, think about yourself, maybe they get you to think about your family. They have no interest in engaging in a politics to get you thinking about the worker that's on the other side of McDonald's making minimum wage and trying to feed three kids, or the workers on the other side of the globe that are being exposed to harmful chemicals. They have no interest in that sort of politics. And so I'm really interested in those practices that begin to shift eaters from having this politics of looking inward, which is to some degree what we are as kind of consumers. We're fixated upon what the nutrition facts label says. We're fixated upon price. We're fixated upon making sure our family eats healthy, nutritious food, which is all important. But we're intentionally not socialized to look outward to think about some of those other things too. And I think that's the type of politics we need to think more about as well. The politics that draws us out as opposed to the politics that forces us to look inward in terms of how we look, self-image, and things like that.
Seems like that sort of rugged individual look has been exported from the United States, frankly, where we got you from. Anastasia Telesetsky, I know you've seen some of these alternative models as well.
Sure.
What have you learned from them?
Sure. And I'll speak to that in a moment, but I just wanted to respond quickly. I think one of the really key issues here is really thinking about labeling, though, and transparency, because we have a right to know. We have a right to know where our food is being sourced from. And I'm really interested in the idea of creating, and this is an opportunity for New Zealand to create sustainability labeling. What would that look like? You know, there's a lot of ongoing, this is, you know, up in, and academics talk about it all the time, but what would it look like actually to make a label that tells us that, no, that chocolate bar you just ate was not harvested from cacao beans that young child slaves had collected, you know? Because the reality of the chocolate industry, for those of you who may not be familiar, is that for many years, particularly in the Côte d'Ivoire, many of the people collecting the chocolate, the cacao beans, were children who had been seized from their families with promises of great things, including an education, and they would find themselves harvesting beans for 3 to 4 years. And there's many stories like this, including in the fishing industry. So that's something I would see as really part of the future of food, is that when we pick up a food, if we can't have that trust relationship, because one of the things you can't have is something like a farmer's market as an alternative model, wherein you know who the producer is because there he or she is standing in front of you. And you can ask the kind of questions you want to ask. And this model is catching on. It's not particularly prevalent here in our urban centers. But one of the models I've seen that's been truly remarkable is urban agriculture or peri-urban agriculture. Most people today in the world live in urban centers. And one of the questions is, most people in the urban world are now depending on rural areas. And our global footprint as a species has really put pressure, a lot of anthropogenic pressures on environmental systems. And so there is now a push to do more and more food production in cities. This is both from an environmental perspective, but frankly, it's also a risk assessment issue where we want to be thinking about national security. You want to be thinking how if you have a large population, you know, how will you be ensuring that people can eat? And so there's been some remarkable work done. I commend you to look at Detroit, Michigan, a city that truly is greening itself and doing some remarkable community-based and for-profit urban agriculture. Because I think it's key. I am very much a supporter of community gardens, and I think they answer many needs. I'm very much a supporter of school gardens, but I think this has to be part, it has to be systematized to be part of our economy, part of our urban economy.
Nicholas Lewis, what do you say to that?
What do I say to that? I'll say two things to that. The first thing I would say is it's an interesting, I don't think it's a tension or necessarily a contradiction, but there's a difference between a politics of the individual that we appeal to through choice and consumer practice, and a politics of collectivity or a collective politics that we somehow foster in other kinds of ways. And my initial response is that we had laid before us two different forms of politics, and the important thing there is that we need to treat that politically in terms of and. We need to do both those kinds of politics and those practices. We need to search for the very difficult political responses of the collective, as well as doing all we can through standard market practices to generate a politics of the individual. And I'll draw you your attention to a little example that might illustrate the importance of putting the politics of the collective into that. With the Sustainable Seas Challenge, I'm doing some work trying to stimulate a blue economy, an economy that is based on a set of practices that pay significant attention to intergenerational prosperity as well as profit today, that pay significant attention to questions of sustainability and ecosystem health. And one of the things that we're trying to do through that project is to catalogue the multiple different types of practices, some communicated and advertised, that are practices that are sustainable, that actually correspond to that conception of a blue economy.
practices that are advertised and made a lot of, but some practices that go on within small enterprises, bigger enterprises, even global enterprises. Little practices that are a bit different. And one of the things that I found really quite fascinating was to put this to a few people working in the seafood industry at the top of the South Island, and to learn that people will routinely go out and seed the commons with mussels. So they'll put spat into the commons. And I'm thinking, hey, what a wonderful kind of practice, because it begins to point to one of the essential problems in all of this, and that is property rights. And one of the neat things about doing stuff around the sea is that the property rights are not clarified in quite the same way and defined in quite the same way as they are on land. So I think we can look to these kind of coastal areas for some examples of how people have to grapple with the commons and with the individual, and how to grapple with the management of environment-economy relations in that kind of context, because it's quite a complicated context. And I think that tells us a lot, not just about New Zealand, but about things happening elsewhere in the world where property rights aren't quite what we assume them to be on farms, for example.
Richard Leheron.
Yes, a couple of points. The transparency debate is about to shift, I think, in New Zealand as we get into gene editing. I was at a workshop last week, and the discussion was focusing on healthcare and on pest control. But it also moved beyond those two domains to the bigger kinds of questions. And what you've actually got is an increasing capacity to make some changes relatively easily and at low cost. But it's likely to be on such a broad scale. So, you know, a food question is not going to be in isolation. It's going to have all sorts of other further dimensions that are
like
sitting
what,
there.
Like what, for example?
Yeah.
Like, so you say food would be connected to another dimension. What would be an example of that?
Obviously healthcare, but also, especially in the New Zealand context, what are some of the pests that are here that might be worked on through the instrumentation of genetic gene editing? And what I think that begins to raise is the fact that we are literally going to move into sort of an unknown landscape of ethical questions that we've not really had before. And just to wrap that particular example off, one commentator at this workshop mentioned that it's possible to get gene editing kits for children, primary age children, and in the US. And so you start to think, okay, well, this is not just a question for the oldies and the middle-aged and such like. It's going to transcend things in a whole set of quite new ways. And I'd be interested in hearing your comments around rights and expectations associated with that, because I suspect that food politics is going to have some very new kinds of dimensions.
Because of this genetic alteration.
Coupled with other things, yeah.
Yeah, and certainly we've had the conversation about modifying foods genetically already to some degree, but you're right, it's reaching yet another level where we're going to have to face all of these questions. I just did not want to miss the opportunity, Michael Carolyn, to talk about sharing economy. And you've suggested that we've got some solutions there. If you could just give us one or two examples, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. So, I have a book coming out in a few months on the food as it relates to the sharing economy. And I guess this, to some degree, speaks about what Nick was talking about, too, the importance of experimenting when it comes to how we do economy, and then trying to learn from those experimentations as scholars, for instance. So one really quick example that I found really interesting that kind of also speaks to what Nick was referring to as kind of a collectivist politics versus an individualist politics. I had interviewed some farmers in North Dakota, conventional farmers growing corn and wheat, and I also had interviewed some urban cooperative members that were heading up a land and food cooperative. And I, among other things, I asked them, what does autonomy mean to you? And then I showed them a list of about 50 words that I had kind of that I thought they might respond to, think of responding to by the word autonomy, and the words were defined. And I asked them to select the five words of what autonomy means for them. And then when I did this, I created two different word clouds to represent how these two different populations thought about the term of autonomy. And the conventional farmers, their number one word that came up most often was independence. When I asked the cooperative members that question, their number one word was interdependence. And so I find this interesting to get back to my point about how I think sometimes our practices, who we interact with, how we interact with them, can lead not to just different understandings about simple things, but could potentially lead to different world views to some degree. A collectivist ontology versus an individualistic ontology, where you look at somebody and you think of them as a potential collaborator as opposed to a potential competitor, right? Where you believe in the we can all do better by getting at this together versus we have to all be at each other's throats. And again, that's something I found hopeful about the sharing economy, is how some of these practices led to not just different behaviors, but led to very different, what seemed like worldviews.
So I guess we're going to close on that now and thank our amazing panelists, Nicholas Lewis and Anastasia and Michael Carolyn and Richard LeHaron. It has been a great pleasure to be sitting here in the moderator chair. Thanks.
For your great questions. Anastasia Telesetsky is a senior lecturer in the Faculty of Law at the University of Auckland. She's co-authored and co-edited the books The International Law of Disaster Relief and Marine Pollution Contingency Planning, State Practices in Asia-Pacific States. Nick Lewis is an associate professor in the School of Environment at the University of Auckland. He co-edited the book Biological Economies, Experimentation, and the Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Richard LeHaron is a professor of geography in the School of Environment at this university. He has co-authored and co-edited books including Knowledge, Industry, and Environment, and Agri-Food, Commodity Chains, and Globalizing Networks. And Michael Carolyn is a professor of sociology and the associate dean of research for the College of Liberal Arts at Colorado State University. He's authored and co-edited books including Reclaiming Food Security, The Real Cost of Cheap Food, as well as Biological Economies, Experimentation, and Politics of Agri-Food Frontiers. Thank you.